Why must we be so brutal? Why must we terrify the world and bloody her knees? Why can't we bury our arguments instead of so many people let them breathe? All of us are innocent. None of us are innocent. We all must take responsibility. There's fortune enough among us, a higher power, fair and just. Why can't we find a way to live peacefully? Can the world survive this killing creed? All of us are innocent. None of us are innocent. We all must take responsibility. There's intelligence enough among us, a higher power, fair and just. Why can't we find a way to live peacefully? Why can't we save our oceans for children's holidays? Keep our mountains and rivers safe. Perhaps we'll see God light one day. All of us are innocent. None of us are innocent. We all must take responsibility. There's holy land enough among us, a higher power, fair and just. Why can't we learn to live peacefully?
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, Peter Schlein interviews Max Paul Friedman about rethinking anti-Americanism.
Professor Max Paul Friedman, author of Rethinking Anti-Americanism. Why do they hate us?
Well, that's a good question. And Americans have been asking that at least since 1899, as I discovered by looking at old copies of the New York Times. We asked it throughout the 20th century. And as it turns out, first of all, they don't hate us if we think about world opinion. The United States, in fact, since we've had the advent of scientific polling in the 1920s and 30s, in almost every country on the planet, at almost any point in time, the United States was more popular than unpopular. Americans were much more liked than disliked. And as it turns out, when you dig into the question, you discover there's a very small fringe of various political movements in history that have really seethed with hatred for the United States. But in fact, we are much more popular around the world than we believe. And that's part of the myth of anti-Americanism.
Who are some of the theys?
Well, again, it depends on who's asking the question. If we think about the contemporary context, Al-Qaeda, for example, seems to have many members who are quite angry at the United States for an array of reasons that they have and who wish it ill. But what I found is that very often in the United States, our discussion about world opinion very sort of rapidly slides into this sense that the theys include foreigners in general. The world hates us into incoherence, to quote a Washington journalist shortly after 9/11. During the run-up to the Iraq War, there was a sense that the whole world was turning against us inexplicably when there was the largest coordinated demonstration in the history of humankind in February 2003 against the looming war with Iraq. Some estimated 15 million people on every continent, including Antarctica, at a weather station, demonstrated against the war. And Americans reacted to that by saying, they must hate us, the world hates us, and they hate us because we are good. They hate us for our freedom. Well, in fact, it turns out that's not a very helpful way of understanding foreign behavior. And this concept of anti-Americanism so often serves as a wall between ourselves and a better understanding of the complexity of the world that I decided to look into its history and discovered it goes back 200 years.
Why 1899? What's significant about 1899?
Well, in that year, there were a number of critical books printed about the rise of U.S. industrial power and how it posed a challenge to European trade. And in a number of European countries, there was a debate in the political realm over how to ensure that the rising challenge of this new world power wouldn't take over the markets that Europeans thought were essential for themselves. Now, that's a dispute about material concerns, but Americans read it as the world is coming to hate us. And they hate us because we are so successful, because we are a wealthy country, because we are free, because we stand for good, which sounds rather curious if you think about it. And nonetheless, that's been a predominant way that Americans have engaged with the world when we encounter hostility or a lack of cooperation.
Are there any countries that you think are legitimately anti-American?
No, not entire countries. At the moment, we have an ongoing dispute with Iran, right? With the Iranian government, which itself produces all manner of vicious propaganda against the United States. We're written about as the Great Satan and so forth. But among Iranians, we're actually quite popular. They are among the most, if you want to use these terms, pro-American populations in the greater Middle East. It's unusual to find, in fact, pollsters have not been able to find populations that are filled with haters of America in any country. What you do find is you find the rise and fall of approval of U.S. policies, which can sometimes erupt in demonstrations or lead to disputes between governments that we then throw into this sort of catch-all category of anti-Americanism, as though what the problem is this underlying hatred, even though public opinion changes radically from month to month and year to year. One example, Germans were asked about their opinion of the U.S. president. Under George W. Bush, it fell to a low of 12% approval. Within a couple of years, Obama was elected. Approval for the U.S. president was 92%. Well, is that a population of haters? No, it's people who can make discriminating judgments on the basis of how they assess the new leader of the same country. And many Western Europeans and people in other places were unhappy with a leader that they saw as rather an inarticulate proponent of unilateral U.S. action, who seemed to have a swagger in his step and who didn't seem to be much interested in their opinions. And when that president left office and a new president came in who seemed to be very good at articulating why it was in the U.S. interests to behave multilaterally, to seek cooperation with other countries and so forth, and who also embodied a set of ideals that people like about America, like the United States is a land of opportunity where anything is possible. All of a sudden, the United States was very popular. So there isn't a deep and underlying and consistent hatred of the United States. That's actually quite rare. What we find is that foreigners are able to make distinguishing judgments about different aspects of the United States and behave accordingly.
Why should we care what Germans think of us? I mean, when's the last time we got asked what we thought of Angela Merkel?
Well, actually, many in Germany are quite interested in American opinion. And this is true in many countries because the United States...
But why?
I beg your pardon?
But why?
Why do they care?
Mm-hmm.
Well, partly because the United States has a lot of power and resources, and when we get a cold, they get pneumonia, economically speaking. When we decide to use our tremendously powerful military machine, that can affect people around the world. The United States it looms very large, and for good reasons, in the minds of many people around the world. It's one reason there's a lot of attention to us. But the reason why we should care is it's not so much about whether we should treat those foreigners well. That's not the issue. Let's just talk in terms of American interests. How can we best achieve our goals? By acting unilaterally, and who cares what they think? Or by trying to use multilateral institutions and coalitions of different countries as force multipliers in order to ensure that we'll have some help in pursuing our goals and that the policies we decide upon are well thought through. I'll tell you why I wrote this book. In 2002, late 2002, during the dispute over the run-up to the Iraq War, the president of France, Jacques Chirac, urged Americans not to go to war in Iraq. He said, don't go there. He said, we know the terrain. I fought in Algeria. He said, this is going to end badly. You'll be seen as a Western army of occupation. You'll awaken Arab nationalism. This will not be in your interest. And so what did we do? Well, we said, oh, those French, they're anti-American. They resent that their star is falling while ours is on the rise. And so we poured French wine into the gutter and boycotted French goods and burned French flags and famously renamed French fries as Freedom Fries. A member of Congress gave a speech saying, we should dig up our boys from the fields of Normandy and bring them home because French soil is no longer a fit resting place for American heroes. And as there were demonstrations against the coming war in Iraq around the world, we said, what is this wave of anti-Americanism? And as I listened to that, I thought, that reminds me of something. It reminded me of the early 60s when the president of France, Charles de Gaulle, told the Kennedy administration, don't go to war in Vietnam. We've been there. We know the terrain. Vietnam had been a French colony before in Indochina. He said, this will end badly. You'll be seen as a Western army of occupation. He told Kennedy, you're going to sink step by step into a quagmire from which you'll have trouble extricating yourselves. He predicted the war would last 10 years and end in American defeat. He said, this will be bad for the United States and bad for the West. So what did we do? We launched a boycott of French goods. We burned French flags. We poured French wine down the drain. A member of Congress gave a speech saying we should dig up our boys from the fields of Normandy and bring them home because French soil is no longer a fit resting place for American heroes. We said de Gaulle is an anti-American. The French, they're anti-Americans. And as there were demonstrations in countries around the world against the war in Vietnam, we said this is a wave of anti-Americanism. And in each case, what did we do? We ignored foreign opinion. We said the problem is they're anti-American, they're irrational, and we marched off into the two foreign policy debacles of the 20th and early 21st century. Well, there's a problem there. Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense who orchestrated the escalation of the war in Vietnam, 30 years later spoke of his regret that we hadn't been able to listen to de Gaulle. He said it was a failure of the imagination to realize that the French were the best informed Westerners on Vietnam, and we didn't take them seriously because we assumed that they just have it in for us. Well, as the book recounts, I went to the records of that event. I went to the French archives to look at what de Gaulle's advisors were telling him, what was going on in the French Foreign Ministry. And they weren't writing, those Americans, they have no culture and they're insignificant. And what they said was they analyzed the intelligence they were getting from Vietnam. There were 17,000 French citizens there. Vietnamese exiles were concentrated in Paris. They had a lot of good information and they tried to share it with us. They tried to help and we couldn't hear it because of this confusing concept we have of anti-Americanism.
Professor Friedman, have there been times in history where there have been other anti-nation type feelings, anti-British Empire, anti-Roman Empire, anything like that?
Indeed, and that's the right question to ask because it should lead us to question the use of the term that we have. In the era of the golden age of the British Empire, British officials would talk about this notion of Anglophobia to explain why they encountered resistance in the Middle East or in South Asia, right, in their Indian colony. And their explanation was, well, you know, when people rise up or criticize us or write against the British presence, the problem is that they don't like British civilization, they don't like our literature, they don't like the values we stand for, right? Anglophobia as a way of explaining resistance to the British Empire. We have Russophobia for the Russian Empire. Why don't they like our iron rule? Well, it's because they don't understand us, they don't like Tolstoy and so forth. Well, what are we doing using an imperial term when we're a democratic power? It's a curious thing, and it's also something that has been used by national chauvinists. The Nazis use the term undeutsch, un-German. French fascists talk about l'anti-France. They talked about this anti-French conspiracy of the Germans, the Jews, and the Freemasons who are going to undermine France. Why do we turn to a term that in other countries, the parallel construction is something that's used by national chauvinists and imperialists? And the reason is that it's terribly exclusive. Among other things, in a domestic context, it suggests that if you criticize aspects of society, government policy, it's not so much that I may disagree with your criticism if I call you anti-American. I'm saying you're against your own country. You're disloyal. You may even be traitorous. Your position is beyond the pale of discussion. It's a very narrowing and exclusive concept that doesn't give us access to the kinds of dissent and critiques that are absolutely essential to making a more perfect union. That's why the founding generation enshrined the right to dissent and to criticize the government as the very first among the amendments in the Constitution. What could be more American than dissent? And yet what I found is that for 200 years, critics in the United States have been tarred with the brush of disloyalty as anti-Americanism from the War of 1812, the war with Mexico in the 1840s, the rise to empire in the 1890s, and across the 20th century. It's a very constricting term that doesn't do justice to the value of dissent to a society.
want to ask you also, Professor Friedman, about another book that you've written, Nazis and Good Neighbors. What's the topic of that book?
Yes, that was about a little-known episode from the Second World War, when the Roosevelt administration was worried that the German emigrant populations living in Latin America, there were about 1.5 million people of German origin spread across Central and South America, would rise up at a signal from Berlin, take over their countries, and open a third front to the south. And this was a concern that was very widely shared in the security establishment, in the Joint Army-Navy Planning Board. They had regular meetings about this problem, about this possibility. The nascent intelligence agencies were also concerned. And in order to thwart that possibility, we began a program that's sort of been lost to history until I recovered it in that book, Nazis and Good Neighbors, under which the FBI was dispatched to find dangerous Nazi spies and saboteurs in Latin America. And the problem is that the people who were sent generally didn't speak German or Spanish, and they didn't know much about the countries where they were supposed to find the bad guys. So what did they do? Well, they did what any of us would do in that situation, right? You get your expense account and you start buying presents and offering money to people for information. You go to the chief of police in Tegucigalpa and say, where are the Nazis? And that opened up a system that was riddled with corruption, where Latin American dictators quickly realized, ah, you want the Nazis. Well, this fellow, this German who owns a farm next to my farm, he's a Nazi. Take him away. And then I can take his land. And we wound up bringing 4,000 people of German origin and put them in a camp in Texas as suspected Nazis. What I discovered when I dug into the archival record is that pretty soon camp commanders started writing to Washington saying, who are you sending us? These people are Spanish speakers, old men. I found 80 Jews who had fled Germany to asylum in Latin America, were picked up because somebody heard them speaking German on the street, and were put in a camp. Some of them already knew what it was like to live behind barbed wire because they had been in Oranienburg or other German concentration camps before fleeing to asylum. And it was a case that in some ways was a precursor to the Guantanamo prison that we operate today. That is, the use of bounty hunters and local sources of denunciations to round up a lot of people as suspected subversives or nowadays as terrorists, who were then locked up in a system that was deliberately placed outside of judicial review. And only as the years pass do we realize we've got some of the wrong people, we're misusing our resources.
Back to your most current book, Rethinking Anti-Americanism, are we sensitive to the charge of anti-Americanism? Do we care as a people?
Yes, well, Americans certainly do seem to have a long record of worrying about this. Not only do I find that the term itself was used as early as 1767, it appears in some of the papers of the founding generation, Franklin, Jefferson, in their correspondence. It's a term that was fought over by left and right through the 19th century and pretty much won by conservatives as a term to try to quash dissent on social and foreign policies in the United States. And it became an official concern of the U.S. government, beginning during the Second World War and especially in the Cold War, when we began to try to have a scientific approach to measuring foreign opinion, to analyzing the source of resistance to the United States, and to coming up with policies to try to combat it. The problem is that it's a very sloppy category of analysis. It's a term that that deducts from the sum total of our knowledge. It doesn't explain foreign behavior. It claims that a whole diversity of movements or leaders or positions abroad, they're all the same. And the problem that they have is that they don't think like us. They don't use their reasoning. They are irrational. Or when we're talking about Latin Americans, they're hot-blooded. They're prisoners of their emotions. And that's why they're having a protest right now. Not, for example, because we fought a war with Mexico and wound up taking half of Mexican territory. Not that there may be a cause there, right? Or an international dispute over which we could argue about the merits. Anti-Americanism is a way of looking at the world as a kind of a mirror. And we have this monologue where we look out at the world, we see a mirror, and we want the mirror to tell us that we're the fairest of them all. Well, that kind of thinking makes for excellent fairy tales, but fairy tales are not very effective in advancing the national interest.
And we've been talking with American University Professor Max Paul Friedman, Rethinking Anti-Americanism, the History of an Exceptional Concept in American Foreign Relations.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
There's so many things going on in the world. Babies dying, mothers crying. How much oil is one human life worth? And what happened to peace on earth? We believe everything that they tell us. They're gonna kill us, so we gotta kill them first. But I remember a commandment thou shalt not kill. And how much is a soldier's life worth? And what happened to peace on earth? And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And whatever happened to peace on earth? So I guess it's just do unto others before they can do it to you. Let's just kill them all and let God sort them out. Is this what God wants us to do? And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And whatever happened to peace on earth? Now you probably won't hear this on your radio, probably not on your local TV. But if there's a time and you're ever inclined, you can always hear it from me. But how much is a picker's word worth? And what happened to peace on earth? But don't confuse caring for weakness. You can't put that label on me. The truth is my weapon of mass protection, and I believe that truth sets you free. And the bewildered herd still believing everything we've been told from our birth. Hell, they won't lie to me, not on my own damn TV. But how much is a liar's word worth? And what happened to peace on earth?
Sisters and brothers, this is Reverend Satchmo getting ready to beat out this Miller sermon for you. My text this evening is when the saints go marching in. Here come Brother Hickenbottom down the aisle with his trombone. Blow it, boy.
Some kids who have two moms, others who have one. I know some kids who have two dads, others who have none. Now, if they love their kids, That's the real test. But I'll tell you what I think is the very best. I've got two mommies, but I'll tell you what is more. I also have two daddies, and I think I'll keep all four. I also have two daddies, and I think I'll keep all four. Kids ask me how this happened. It's a little hard to say. All that I can tell them is I really like it just this way. 'Cause you know sometimes three of them are busy, but then there's always one who can come and play with me. I've got two mommies, but I'll tell you what is more. I also have two daddies, and I think I'll keep all four. I also have two daddies, and I think I'll keep all four. Now sometimes life is hard, as everybody knows. Sometimes things just don't go your way. That's just the way it goes. But with two mommies and two daddies, the skies are always bright. There's always one to cheer me up, make everything alright. I've got two mommies, but I'll tell you what is more. I also have two daddies, and I think I'll keep all four. I also have two daddies, and I think I'll keep all four.
That's all, folks.